I am Michael Moller. I teach systematic theology at the Lutheran Seminary in Philadelphia. Originally, I'm from Germany. I'm a pastor, was ordained in 1986 in East Germany and served a congregation in Wismar at the Baltic coast, and came to the United States permanently in 1990 to teach at the seminary in Philadelphia. Yesterday, we talked about an assessment of the situation in which we find ourselves. I call the series A World Out of Balance, and I reflected on some of the deeper reasons that might have led us into the situation in which we find ourselves, particularly in the Western world, which I call an identity crisis of humanity. We seem to have lost an understanding of who we are and what we are called to be, and I think that is the root cause for all the problems that we find ourselves in regard to ecology, but in regard to many other societal problems that we have to face. I have to wrap up that session a little bit by going through the second part, speaking about some of sociological reasons that I think are present in our situation. And I want to make one comment about the economic aspect as well. That was one question that was raised at the end of the session yesterday. It was mentioned that there seemed to be a kind of contradicting tendency in the world to, on the one side, to particularity, that people more and more withdraw themselves from the community and find refuge in smaller units. You can see that in group behavior. You can also see that in the call for renewal of the family. You can also see that in nationalism and all the ideologies that propagate one particular culture over and against other cultures. But almost contradicting to that tendency to particularity is a tendency to globality in the business world. As you all know, corporations nowadays cannot afford to neglect foreign policy as politicians might be able to do so. Every major corporation, wherever it is placed in the world, whether in Germany and the United States or in Asia and Japan, needs to take into account global developments and needs to have a global strategy for its own work. And that seems to cause a problem because all these corporations seem to be less and less under control in regard to political entities and political structures that were formed to create an economic environment that is helpful and positive for a particular country. It is clear that the marketplace is global today, and you can see that in two different ways. One is that that there is some kind of exploitation of the developing countries in two stages, and we sometimes forget about one of the two. One, of course, is the consumer behavior. If I would ask you to look at the labels of the clothes that you are wearing, you probably would detect that most of the stuff comes from Thailand, from China, and from other Asian countries. That is because the production costs are much lower in these countries, which is directly at the cost of the people who work there. If you have ever seen a garment factory in Indonesia or in Thailand or in Hong Kong or in China, you can see the working conditions, remind yourself on on the brutal capitalism of the 18th and 19th century that seemed to be somewhat out of place in the 20th century. And that takes even place in the United States. I don't know if some of you came late enough to have seen that story in the news that that in the Los Angeles area, a sweatshop was detected by law enforcement, where Thai workers, over 20 Thai workers, were held hostage and used as slave laborers for over 3 years without ever being allowed to leave the building, having to work for $1.50 an hour, 17 hours a day, and the money was all taken away from them to pay for their accommodation and their transportation. So this does not only take place somewhere else, but it takes place right in the midst of us. So on the one hand, consumer behavior, that we want to be the cheapest and that we purchase only the cheapest, which then supports this kind of economic development, is quite obvious, but also that this global development makes companies looking for the cheapest option, and that means that they will always produce and develop products at the cost of the most vulnerable. You can see that in the development of child labor, which takes dramatic proportions, particularly in Asian countries. And we were debating yesterday afternoon with some people how we can tackle that problem, because I think it has to do again with a more global and a deeper problem that is present, which has to do with the identity crisis of humanity. I personally believe that there is an interconnectedness between what I call the anthropological crisis, this identity crisis, that we don't really know who we are anymore, and this kind of behavior. It is very easy to blame corporations for it as the one who do it, but we have to realize that we ourselves do it and support it, that the economic practices of corporations like that, of the garment industry and so on, only reflects the way we behave as human beings. Maybe we personally, and I think we have a good deal to do with it, but also how human beings behave and act at this particular point in time. And therefore, I think that the economic question is connected to the anthropological question, to the question, who are human beings and how can we understand their behavior? How can we find a way that they behave in an acceptable way, which is the ethical question? There's another aspect of that economic problem that I want to mention here before I go into other sociological reasons for this situation, the world being out of balance, and that is, I think, a lack of political leadership that could balance the short-term profit-oriented interest of a capitalistic corporation and the long-term national and global interest of people. I think that is a particular problem of the United States, that there is not much economic leadership by the government for a variety of reasons. The philosophy that government should interfere as little as possible in the marketplace, a tendency that is even enlarged by the new developments of the Republican the Republican Party becoming stronger in the political landscape. Other countries handle that quite differently. I know that from Germany, that there is an interaction between the government and the economic sector that is, by the way, even deplored by American companies that think that there is too much political clout in the economic sector that makes it very hard for American companies to compete. And we know the same complaints about the situation in Japan, where politics and economics is not as separated as you have it in the United States. I think there is a good reason to look for political leadership in the economic sector. If the economic sector is totally let loose, then only the short-term interest will be served and not the long-term interest nationally and globally. Again, I think that the economic situation is a reflection of human nature. We have, as many people say politically, that people get exactly the government that they deserve. I think also we got exactly the economy that we deserve. The economy is only a reflection of who we are. And then the task of ethics would then be to detect the interconnectedness between human behavior and individual behavior and national and international trends. Some other reasons that I intended to give for the situation of the world being out of balance that I call sociological reasons. I just briefly mentioned some of them. The destruction of the family structure that is clearly a product of the mid-20th century, the force, the economic force that people feel and then make the decision that two parents are working, that the children do not grow up in a stable family environment where they can learn behavioral rules, I have two small children, I know how hard it is for kids to learn how to behave, how to discern, how to think about right and wrong and things like that in a situation where both parents are working and coming home late and being exhausted, picking children up from daycare. This learning process is much less possible. And here I think individual decisions are quite important. I don't know if we really need all the benefits of this kind of lifestyle, or whether we would be better off long term in our own life if we would give up some of the profits that we gain from that lifestyle. I can only tell you one story from my own situation. When we were house shopping in Philadelphia 5 years ago, the realtor that looked at my income said that we need this kind of house, and she showed me about 15 houses that I thought were too expensive for me, and I didn't want to spend that much money on housing because I didn't want to work for housing, but I wanted to have housing as part of my life and wanted to do other things in my life than just work for a nice house. And this realtor was not able to understand that. She was simply, and she had all the interest of understanding it, because in the end she wanted to sell me a house. We finally had to change realtors after she showed me 15 different houses. And the next one was a little smart and understood my point and showed me the house. He showed me only one house and we bought it. But for many people, it's unimaginable that people would say, I don't need certain things. We get every other day, we get a visitor from the cable company because we are probably the only household in the whole neighborhood that doesn't have cable TV. And they ring the bell and say, we have this incredible offer, you know, you get it for whatever long for free. And I said, we don't need it for free because we don't watch TV. And this person always looks at me completely blank, you know, I don't understand that answer. How can somebody not watch TV? That's unimaginable. I think that consumerism, financial resources, are a trap in which we fall easily because we create all the needs, and it's almost the situation where by consuming we create more needs. And that, of course, is very cleverly used by the producing sector, because the main objective of people that produce goods is that other people buy them and consume them. This destruction of the family structure is a high price that we pay for our living standard, and I would like to raise the question whether the price that we pay for that justifies what we get. Second, I think a very important reason for this kind of moral crisis that I spoke about yesterday is the communications revolution. I think that that is a very underestimated impact on the way human beings behave and the way human beings perceive the world and live. I personally grew up without television. We didn't have a TV at home because my parents could not afford a TV. But we don't have a TV now in our own house, because I think TV is a very a dangerous instrument to control and to endanger the way human beings live, because the TV degrades people to be passive receivers. There is no interaction, or almost no interaction possible with a television set, unless you have very clever TV programs. And even with the new computer technology that makes things much more interactive, it doesn't really allow you to expand your horizons that much, but it makes you passive. It makes you reactive and passive. TV, by definition, is non-interactive. People do not learn, for example, to argue with their TV. They are only fed by their TV, and therefore they become more and more passive. One thing that I observe in my teaching with students at the seminary is that less and less people become able to argue for something or against something. They either think this is right or this is wrong, but they don't know why. And they have a hard time learning to argue for or against something. So I started to use as a method the old traditional academic method of disputation in my classes, that students are forced to take a position and then argue for it and argue against it. I think that the communications revolution has something to do with that inability, which of course then has a direct impact on morality and ethical reflection, because if I don't know how to argue for something, I cannot be really sure if something is right or wrong. A third reason, I think, is the individualism in a market-oriented society. The market-oriented society is driven by need and fulfillment of the individual. We are constantly told by the strategist of the marketplace of what we need and how we can fulfill that need. If you watch advertisement, you can make very interesting observation about the images of humanity in a variety of cultures. It's actually interesting also to observe TV or radio advertisement in different cultures and how different they are. You can learn a lot about cultures by observing that. But the marketplace is forcing people to only think about the now. instead of long-term thinking. I always ask people when I have a chance to talk to them to, whenever you watch TV, take a little piece of paper and use the advertisement time and make a mark on a piece of paper how often now is used in advertisement. It is really amazing to see that that's one of the most often words used in advertisement, that that you need a new car now, you need to do that exercise machine now, you need to buy this or that now, because it's only a short time and it's limited, and it's kind of ridiculous because you hear that, you see that ad like half a year long run, and they always say, act now because it soon will be over. That is something that really forces you to think only short term and not long term. What are my long term needs? How can I live in a way that makes my life fulfilled? It's only this instant gratification of needs that I have. I think in the individualism of the market-oriented society, there is a lack of learning opportunities. Learning is replaced by producing. Value is determined by the amount of production rather by the time of learning. I had to learn that for myself that the teachers are not very respected in the U.S. culture. Teacher are kind of regarded as people who didn't figure out how to produce something in order to make money. And that is, I think, a symptom that is quite important to understand, that learning and teaching is regarded as maybe an interesting pastime and maybe something needed for children, but not something for adults that are able to produce and to live in the real world. We are constantly told that the teaching world is not the real world, but the real world is the world of production. These are some of the issues that I think are important to feed into that analysis of the situation that I started yesterday. And I want to move on now and talk a little bit about how can we come beyond understanding the situation to develop an ethics that would give people orientation, that would help people to learn anew what is right and what is wrong. How can we develop an ethics that that would lead us back to into a more balanced way of life? Now there are two proposals out there in the political world that seem to be very attractive to people that I think are dangerous and might not help us really. One is a proposal of the so-called moral majority. And the term moral in this title that the group gives, I think, itself, shows already the concern that I share, that there is a decline of morality, that something needs to be done to relearn what is right and what is wrong. But the moral majority, I think, is trying to do that by re-establishing the old values. And by romanticizing the past, by trying to tell us we just have to go back to the old ways and then everything will be just fine. But I think that the premise of the moral majority, that you can resist the evil by returning to the past, is wrong. We cannot return to the 50s in the first place, because there is no way back in history. History has, whether you regard it as nice or unfortunate, but has a way to go forward and not to go backward. Time travel is science fiction, and we cannot pretend that we live in the 50s today. It will not be a very successful experiment if we would try to do that, And I think that that people begin to realize that already by looking really at some of the proposals of the moral majority, and it becomes quite clear that they are not workable. So we cannot return to the past, which is romanticized anyway, the perfect family of the 50s with two parents and two children, which is idealized, did not exist anyway. There were other conflicts and other problems at that time that people had to deal with, and that is, it is quite clear that that is not our time. The other proposal that is out there is the proposal of the what I call the liberal side of the political spectrum, which would say that some kind of an elite, some kind of group of people that understand all the dilemmas that we live in, has to come up with some solutions, and then people have to be almost forced to live by these solutions. The term that is associated with that is political correctness. Some people determine what is politically correct. Most of them belong to some kind of a cultural elite. And then people who do not accept that are targeted as one who are wrongdoers. I think that proposal is also flawed for a variety of reasons. One is that elites tend to develop into some kind of dictatorship. You can observe that through the history. Whenever it was proposed that that an elite should rule, that it very certainly ended up and came into a situation of some kind of dictatorship, where for the sake of the political ideal, people were oppressed and were forced to live a life that they didn't want to live. Secondly, I think that there is no easy solution, that if we would live all and act all politically correct, the problems would be solved. I think that we rather have to develop an ethic that would take into account that we have to accept the dilemmas, that that we live already in a situation where a perfect solution is not possible anymore. In the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of debate in the Green Movement, which said that we live 5 minutes to 12. And therefore we have to do something. It's very dramatic, and if we don't do anything the next 5 minutes of human existence, then we will all end up in a catastrophe. I personally think that we live way fast beyond 12 o'clock, and that that we have to develop a lifestyle that takes that into account, that we cannot pretend that human beings can gain control over the situation in a perfect way, but we rather have to acknowledge our imperfectness to live with a situation, and then try to make the best out of that. So that would be my proposal. That that sounds a little frustrating, because of course everybody is looking for a very precise, helpful, and concrete answer. I think that there is no easy answer, and that people who promise easy answers, whether from the right or from the left, are demagogues that are not very helpful. But that the task of the human family is to understand the situation and then to come up with very limited and and local solutions to problems rather than trying to find a global solution to the situation in which we find ourselves. It's now 11 o'clock. It's a good breaking point for me anyway, because I now want to shift then in the second part of my presentation today to ethics and how we do ethics. But in about 1 minute or so, we want to observe a minute of silence to recognize, to remember, and to reflect the second and hopefully forever last dropping of a nuclear bomb 50 years ago to the town of Nagasaki in Japan. In about 1 minute, the children will come out and ring the bell, and then we will observe 1 minute of silence. And I think that this directly also relates to our topic. This is part of our human identity, that we have chosen as a people to use the resources that we have for destruction. And that's the ambivalence and the dilemma that we live in, that all what we have can be used for destruction and for construction. And it's up to us to make the decision in which way we want to go. Certainly the dropping of the atomic bomb in 1945 is a moral issue as much as it is a political and military issue. And I think I don't know if some of you watched the debate over the last half year or so, starting with the exhibition in Washington, D.C., the exhibition of the airplane that dropped the first bomb. Certainly there are arguments of both sides on both sides that are valid and sound. And one thing that ethics has to do is to determine how can you reach a conclusion, how can you determine if an action can be considered morally right or wrong. And as we all know, the outcome is very different. There are people today, and probably among us, who think that the dropping of a nuclear bomb was an immoral act. And there are people probably also among us that think that the dropping of the nuclear bomb was a necessary evil that prevented greater evil. So that is one of the issues that ethics has to do. It has to help people to have a structured discussion about why we think something is wrong or something is right. Immanuel Kant, the famous German philosopher of the 18th century that I mentioned yesterday in regard to the Enlightenment, has said that human beings basically face three major questions. The one question is, what can I know? The second question, what should I do? And the third question, what can I hope for? And all these three questions could be summarized in the one question: what is the human being? What is man? In ethics, we deal with the second question, the question of what should I do? Is there anything like right or wrong? Does it make sense to act in a certain way or another? Can we expect other people's action, and can we judge other people's action? We certainly have impressions about all these questions. We are brought up with certain values that are determined by our upbringing, that are determined by our cultural background, that are determined by our religious background. We judge our values, and we judge our deeds, and we make constantly decisions. We not always reflect these decisions, but certainly we act. And we can act only by deciding to act. In a way, it's already an ethical decision if we decide to get out of bed in the morning. Fortunately, we do not reflect most of the time very long about that, but we simply do it. But certainly by acting, we are making decisions, and we have a whole variety of choices for action in front of us, and by choosing one particular avenue of action, we already made an ethical judgment. There is something that we call conscience that tells us personally what we feel is right and wrong. But we all know that this conscience works very differently in different people, and we don't really know what it is. Sometimes we experience a conflict between our own values and values of people that we live with. And there are a variety of issues, particularly in the United States, that were debated over the last year with great vigor and emotion. The question of abortion. We have the chance to debate in about less than an hour the question of capital punishment as an ethical dilemma that we are in. Sexuality is one of the issues that is debated. And it's very interesting that in today's church, unlike many centuries of the life of the church, where doctrinal questions, how we can think about God, who really is God, how is God related to Jesus, and the Holy Spirit, and all these questions were a source of conflict in the church. Today, the major source of conflict in the church seems to be ethical questions. The sexuality statement, the statement on race, the whole question of affirmative action. I don't know if you... are you going to address that in one of your sessions?
Next week.
Okay, so those of you who are still here next week will have a chance to debate that. These are all very controversial issues, and I found it interesting that in the last decade or so, ethical questions became the focus of debate in the church. I brought you a little handout that I use in my class to show you that there are two almost opposite ways to have an ethical debate, to have a debate about what is right and what is wrong. And I think some of the source of our conflict is that we operate with different models, and it's very hard to talk to each other if we use these different models and don't understand how the other person comes to his or her conclusion. So let me hand out these things and I explain them to you very briefly, because we don't have that much time left, and I think that I have to continue that on Friday when we continue the series. Some people think that there are only two major models, the first and the third one on the line, and that's a second one, situationism, which is a relatively new model in ethics, is only a compromise between the two and does not really qualify as its own model. I gave you the names. All the names are, of course, very technical, like always in academics. They come from the Greek or from Latin. The first one, to the very right, if you hold the paper this way, is called deontology, comes from the Greek word die, it is necessary, and is also called ethical formalism. This is basically a model that operates with certain laws and values moral behavior by their congruency and by their relation to certain laws that are regarded as present. Teleology almost does the opposite. Telos is a Greek word which means goal, and some people call this school also consequentialism. this school of ethics values the morality of an action by the outcome rather than by the laws that apply to the situation. So, a teleologist would ask, what is the result of this particular action? And when you take this example of dropping the nuclear bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, people would argue it brought a quick end of the war. And that would mean then the action is morally justified because it created some good. Now, one could argue still whether the good that was produced was greater than the harm that was done to the people that experienced the nuclear blast in Japan, and then people would argue a lot more people would have died if the bomb would not have been dropped. And of course that could be argued for, but as you can see, people would then argue always with the outcome. The means are justified because the end is positive. Now the problem of that particular school then of course is that it lacks a certain attention to the means. The means themselves are unimportant as long as a positive end is reached. The other ethical model, deontology or ethical formalism, would argue with certain laws that exist. And normally religious communities would argue that way. For example, there are the Ten Commandments against which I measure human action. And as long as I keep the commandments, then an action is morally right. So if the commandment says, thou shall not kill, then that means that killing is not a possible a human action, even if the outcome might be positive. Even if when I kill Hitler, the survival of millions of people might be guaranteed, still, because the law says thou shall not kill, I can't do it. Now, the problem of this particular ethical approach, of course, is the lack of flexibility. I just follow the rules, the ethical laws, and I cannot leave the body of laws in order to respond appropriately in a certain situation to guarantee a positive outcome. This was really a debate in Germany, for example, in regard to the assassination of Adolf Hitler. Some people believe until today that some theologians, like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, joining a plot that has at its goal to kill Hitler was something objectively wrong to do because it would violate the law of killing. Now, I gave you on the column of specific forms an indication that not only religions use ethical formalism, also political rules could function as this body of laws that would govern moral behavior, or cultural laws or philosophical rules. The most prominent philosopher that developed this model of ethics, Immanuel Kant again, developed what he calls a categorical imperative that I wrote down on that paper: act in a way that your action can be the foundation for universal laws. And he was convinced that this principle, if that principle would be applied to all of our action, that then people would act morally acceptable. You could try that out and think it out in certain ethical problems and see whether it works or not. On the other hand, you have a teleology exists also in specific forms. egoism, for example, is a form of what I call consequentialism or teleological ethics, saying whatever is best for me is the best way to act. So if I always act in my best interest, then I act morally right. Now, of course, that must not be a very primitive egoism that tries to live at the expense of others, because you soon begin to realize if you overdo it, it will harm yourself. Part of a living environment for myself is also that I interact responsibly with my environment, and therefore egoism. We are almost trained to regard egoism as something suspect or morally suspect. At least that must not necessarily be the case. There is an healthy egoism. And then the most prominent form, of course, of teleology is utilitarianism. The most prominent philosopher that developed is John Stuart Mill, who said that right is what produces the most common good. So again, the outcome of the action determines whether it is morally right or wrong. And the more good is produced by an action, the more likely it is that this action is morally acceptable. Now, I think that in the United States, some of the bitterness of the ethical debate that we experience, particularly in religious communities, comes because we operate with two different models at the same time. The basic cultural model in the United States is utilitarianism, I think, that whatever produces a good outcome is an advisable action. Whereas religious communities operate mainly with ethical formalism, orienting their actions according to certain laws that are prescribed, whether it is in the Bible or in another religious book that is used as the source for values and judgment. And that, of course, creates then a problem. If we operate with two different models at the same time, we are not very clear in how to argue for our respective outcomes, because we mix up the models. I gave you then also a couple of other indications of how the model would work. The principle would say that whatever is universal, that's the principle of this first model, whatever is universal is positive, whatever can be applied universally. It's something like the golden rule. Whereas the second model, the teleology, would say whatever is useful, that should be made the principle of our action. And therefore the question that is asked in the first model is this right? Is this right to drop an atomic bomb? And in the third model, you would ask the question, is it good or is it useful to drop the atomic bomb? You can see, of course, that by asking these two different questions, you can come to a quite different outcome of whether you regard an action as appropriate or not. I think that that all these models can be found in the Bible. The Bible does not provide us with one particular ethical model. Most people think that the Bible operates only with commands. But if you read biblical texts, you will soon see that that commands are not the only way the Bible directs our moral behavior. Certainly, commands play an important role. Most prominent, the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20, but also then the rules in Matthew 5 and the Sermon of the Mount. Whereas the third model could be found more in places where a hope or a vision is used to determine how we can behave, how we can make moral judgments. I leave it to that. This was of course very brief. I just want to talk briefly about the situationism that I didn't mention so far. Most people think of Joseph Fletcher as one who developed this this model, although there are some people who think that Joseph Fletcher is really not a good representative of situationism and developed it further. Joseph Fletcher himself said that the most moral action is the one that produces the most love. And he developed this model particularly as a compromise between formalistic ethics and consequentialist ethics, because he thought that formalistic ethics was overly directive and consequentialist ethics was non-directive, because it's really hard to tell the outcome of an action if you don't know the outcome yet. How can you make a decision if you are the president who has to decide the dropping of the bomb, whether the outcome is really the one that you expect, or whether the outcome is quite different from the outcome that you expected? And therefore, consequentialist ethics tends to be very non-directive. Situation ethics, Joseph Fletcher thought, falls between these two extremes, but is apparently closer to consequentialist ethics, to asking for the outcome. The most moral action is the one, Fletcher said, which produces the greatest amount of love. To decide that, you have to be fully acquainted with all the facts surrounding the case and any possible consequences. And love, and he calls it also the agape principle, he used the Greek word, would be the principle which helps to decide then, once you analyze the situation of what is right and what is wrong. Now, specific forms then of this model, as you can see on the handout, then would be some kind of ethics committees. Some of you might be familiar with that from hospitals, that hospitals in biomedical ethics questions, in a question of medical ethics, neither resort to certain rules that, for example, you should never end life and therefore you have to use all life-sustaining equipment as long as possible. Neither are they able always to use a consequentialist model to say, okay, the best outcome is ending life without suffering. That doesn't work in any case. And therefore, in hospitals, you will find ethics committees that debate every case rather than setting up rules or deciding what consequence would be the most desirable. They debate every single case, and that's kind of a tendency of situation ethics, that you look at a particular question in a particular time, in a particular place, and then have a debate of what might be the most desirable action to do. I have to close here. I'm sorry that I talked so long. I want to have some time for discussion, but today was a little shorter because of the minute of silence. And I'm not done with that yet, because the next step would then be to apply that to environmental ethics. How could these models be made useful in environmental ethics? So I have to postpone that for the next session on Friday. I hope some of you will still be here, and if you're interested, to have the time to come then for the next session on Friday. Thanks for your attention. Well, there are some people who believe that there are other offers, that there are other models that one could operate with. For example, the model of virtue that was already developed by Aristotle. I personally think that that there are only these three models. And actually there are only these two models, and that situationism is some kind of trying to compromise the edges of the first and the third model and try to avoid some of the shortcomings of these models and utilize both directions in order to develop moral judgment. But there are other people who think that there are other models. I don't know if we have more ethicists here in the room that...
there is an Alistair MacIntyre and the whole virtue ethics character-based approach.
Yeah. Exactly. That's the newest thing that is debated as kind of an alternative. I don't see it really as an alternative.
I use something very similar to this in the course that I teach in ethics. And when I'm done, I say, well, first of all, the way I do it is I have everybody in the class do an exercise first in which they have to decide which of 10 to 20 people go on a list to get an antidote that will save their life. Mm-hmm. And when they know some information that medical ethics may never know, gender, occupation, age, medical status, etc. And on the basis of that information, some of them, you know, use a good consequentialist approach and say, well, you know, we're weighing the value of youth versus age, health versus illness, and they come up with a list of 10 on the basis of various kinds of criteria. Others will say, how the heck can I judge the value of your life, or David's life, or anyone else's life? And so they put 20 numbers on a hat and draw out 10, and they say, this is how we're going to do it, and they argue that on the basis of fairness, the principle of fairness that they watch for. So once I have to do that, then we sit down and talk about these kinds of moral theories, and then the final thing I say is that none of it, I haven't met a pure deontologist in my life, and I haven't met a pure teleologist. I think we all work with some kind of a mixed moral theory, and that's precisely what you were responding to Roger with. But it is helpful to understand that we do react in certain ways. I mean, how many of us would not recoil from the argument that we should shoot everybody over 70 in order to save the country the cost of health care?
Well, I was thinking a more close to home moral question is how much resources and money was spent to save this one guy who is up there in the mountain who had just the crazy idea to climb a mountain? And how much of these resources are we withholding from people that do not make that kind of decision of entertaining themselves but have no choice, children in poor neighborhoods that don't get immunization, which would be much more critical for the future of the society than getting one person who just had the crazy idea of climbing...